Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU FM Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capital Report.
Dialysis patients are chased by hurricanes as they try to find a refuge with reliable power so they can stay alive.
You know, the goal was to try to do as many treatments as possible that were going to be safe pre-storm.
Also this week, Florida leaders want residents to recover from Irma but not forget it.
All of us have to be prepared and continue to drill that in to the new residents.
We'll also learn how Florida might respond legislatively to the state's opioid crisis. Hear the tale of a deaf man serving a life sentence in prison for a murder he still swears he didn't commit. And we'll start a college savings plan. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capital Report. Certainly and deservedly, the attention on hurricane recovery has now shifted to the devastated island of Puerto Rico. Amidst all the devastation and suffering, here's one storm-related story that hasn't gotten much play. People whose lives depend on dialysis are especially vulnerable during a hurricane. The machines that replace their kidneys need reliable electricity and water to operate. That's part of why 89 dialysis patients from St. Thomas fled to Puerto Rico after Hurricane Irma. And then they had to evacuate again, this time to Miami, because of Hurricane Maria. From member station WLRN in Miami, Sammy Mack has that story.
When Hurricane Irma slammed into the U.S. Virgin Islands, Alvin Joseph was home in St. Thomas with his wife, his oldest granddaughter, and four of his great-grandkids.
About 2:30 in the morning, my wife, we went in the little boy's bedroom, took out a mattress and a back spring. So when she called me, one of the ceiling tiles had already disappeared out of the roof. And we could have seen the sky. By the time we left out of the bedroom to go back in the living room, whoosh, roof was gone.
The family survived the night, but not unscathed.
We had to go to the hospital with the oldest boy because one of the light fixtures fell out of the roof and had caught him in the head.
So Joseph carefully navigated the roads full of debris to get to St. Thomas's only hospital.
So much structural damage was done to the hospital.
That's when Joseph realized he had his own medical crisis to deal with.
Downstairs in the bottom floor where the dialysis center is, there was too much water leaking through the ceiling, so we couldn't be dialyzing the place.
Joseph has kidney disease. 18 years ago, he got his first kidney transplant, but that one failed after a decade. He got another transplant, which didn't last as long. And then 2 years ago, he started dialysis at that hospital. 3 days a week, for about 4 hours at a time, Joseph would sit hooked to a machine that cleaned his blood. Irma upended that routine. Joseph is one of nearly 100 dialysis patients who were airlifted from St. Thomas to Puerto Rico. They received treatments there for a couple of weeks. Then Hurricane Maria came for Puerto Rico.
They told us that we was in a flood zone, so we had to leave. Come to Miami.
For now, the dialysis patients are being housed at Florida International University.
We're going to make the plans for a long term.
Michael Christensen is one of the people in charge of handling the logistics of the dialysis evacuees. He's the director of market development for the dialysis company Fresenius. The company runs and supplies dialysis clinics all over the world, including the one in St. Thomas. Fresenius recently finished construction on a brand new clinic in Perrine and was about to start the certification process.
On average, it'll take about 90 days after we notify them that we're ready.
But with 89 new patients on their way to Miami, government regulators worked to get the clinic operational in a matter of days. Relocating dialysis patients in an emergency is a race against the clock. Missed appointments with the artificial kidney can quickly cause fluid buildups and organ damage. Several Florida counties include dialysis representatives in their emergency response coalitions, including Broward, Palm Beach, and Hillsborough. But not all of them do. In many ways, the hurricane response for dialysis patients has been driven by dialysis providers.
It's a big logistical chessboard.
Kenny Gardner is a regional vice president with the DaVita Dialysis Company.
You know, the goal was to try to do as many treatments as possible that were going to be safe pre-storm.
Gardner says patients across Florida who evacuated were sent to clinics elsewhere. And the company hired fuel tankers to fill generators for its facilities and employees. DaVita operates a clinic in Key West. It's the only outpatient dialysis center in the Keys. After Hurricane Irma, the clinic closed for about a week. It wasn't damaged. Gardner says the clinic was prepared to operate on generator power. Problem was, it couldn't reopen until it had steady access to water. Dialysis is a procedure that relies on osmosis between a person's blood and carefully titrated electrolyte fluids.
So that water, the fact that it's a big part of that component and interacting with their blood becomes super critical.
The Keys Dialysis Clinic has since reopened. In Miami, Alvin Joseph says he's especially grateful to the volunteers who heard about the dialysis patients from St. Thomas and brought them West Indian food.
Peas and rice, vegetables, kingfish, and stew chicken. I'm not saying that the food that they're feeding us isn't well enough, but ain't nothing like a home-cooked meal. Yeah.
It could be a while before Joseph can go home. St. Thomas continues to reel from the effects of Irma. Early reports indicate it could be months before the island's only hospital is fully operational again. I'm Sammy Mack in Miami.
While many Floridians are moving on after Hurricane Irma ripped through the state, government leaders are working to keep the disaster top of mind. And we get that story from Regan McCarthy.
Almost as soon as Hurricane Irma blew through the state, Florida residents began working to recover.
The storm brings out the absolute best in our state, absolute best in everything we offer. The volunteerism, the donations, all that is just, it's so powerful how we rally around those that are hurt. But you know what? It brings out the absolute worst in people.
That's Florida CFO Jimmy Patronis. He says while storms pave the way for people to show kindness to one another, they also pave the way for what he calls fraudsters.
Do not let somebody come in knocking on your door who's offering to fix your problems. If it sounds too good to be true, it is.
Patronis is talking about what's called assignment of benefits. It's the practice of a homeowner signing over his or her insurance benefits to a contractor who promises to repair their damaged home. But Patronis says all too often that contractor is just posing as someone who wants to help and instead takes the money and leaves. He says the assignment of benefits system is filled with fraud.
All I'm thinking about is what is down the road if we don't get our arms around this. And in the category, the way I categorize it, it's a category 5 hurricane that is brewing off the coast of Florida. And it's focused right now in Palm Beach, Broward, and Dade counties.
But Patronis says that disaster could spread to threaten more and more of the state. He says in order to protect Florida, a legislative fix is needed. It's something he plans to keep at the front of lawmakers' minds as they head back to the Capitol for January's legislative session. And Florida Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam says he'll be working to keep Irma on people's minds as well.
The most dangerous thing in Florida politics is a short memory. And whether it's a short memory about what we have to do to create a culture of preparedness, whether it is households really being serious about preparing for hurricane season, whether it is about making sure that we are paying attention to which insurance we've bought and which insurance we haven't bought, and regardless of where in Florida we may be, speaking as someone who lives in the middle of the state who had Charlie, Francis, Jean, and now Irma, have an eye wall come across my county, all of us have to be prepared and continue to drill that in to the new residents.
Putnam says staying vigilant in the face of storms is critical, but it's not always enough. He says Irma nearly wrecked huge swaths of the state's agriculture industry.
So where we were hoping to pick 75 million boxes this year, everybody was excited about it. It was the first year we were really seeing some positive growth there. When you look at the losses, that'll probably easily be cut in half.
Meanwhile, Ken Lawson, who heads the state's tourism arm, Visit Florida, wants to show the rest of the world that Florida is recovering. He says he has a plan to show tourists what Florida has to offer.
We just put live cams on the various beaches across Florida and start using social media to show in real time that Florida is safe. Here you are in Clearwater. Here you are at Panama City Beach. Here you are at St. Pete Beach. Come down and enjoy us.
Lawson, Putnam, and Petronas joined a slate of other speakers at a recent summit titled the Florida Future Forum. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
A 57-year-old woman who had been a resident of the Rehabilitation Center at Hollywood Hills has died. That brings to 12 the number of deaths that are part of a criminal investigation into the Broward County facility. Hollywood police said today Dolores Biamonte died yesterday. Although a news release from authorities did not provide details, 8 residents died and the nursing home was evacuated September 13th. That was 3 days after the facility's air conditioning was knocked out by Hurricane Irma. The other 4 deaths have occurred since the home was evacuated. The state has taken actions against the nursing home, placing a moratorium on admissions, suspending the facility from the Medicaid program, and suspending its license. The nursing home has filed a lawsuit in Leon County Circuit Court challenging the admissions moratorium and Medicaid suspension. Still to come on Capitol Report, Governor Scott wants to put $50 million and new prescription limits into fighting opioid abuse.
They'll give you quite a few days of these opioids, and when you don't need that many days.
We'll hear the latest on the case of a deaf inmate who's currently serving life in prison.
You've got to remember, this is a deaf inmate, not a hearing inmate. Deaf has a different world that they're living while they're in the prison system.
And just like you should do for retirement planning, we'll find that paying for college is less painful when you take a portfolio approach.
I ended up doing a 529 and the Florida prepaid for my children. And so I think that it's also a combination of investments are very good.
When it comes to the devastating abuse of opioids, whether in the form of prescription drugs or street heroin, no state has been spared. Florida Governor Rick Scott is promising to make the opioid crisis a top priority in the coming legislative session. Nick Evans has more.
This year, the lawmaking session begins in January. It also happens to be an election year, and state officials are staking out policy positions a bit earlier than usual. Governor Rick Scott, widely rumored to be mulling a U.S. Senate bid, is calling for $50 million to fight opioid abuse.
We know that the opioid epidemic is a challenging issue that requires a multi-focused approach. That's why my proposed legislation and funding will help address multiple levels of this epidemic, from doctors and prescribers to state and community programs to law enforcement officers who are the front line of this fight.
The governor also wants to ratchet back prescriptions.
We'll fight to place a 3-day limit on prescribed opioids unless strict conditions are met for a 7-day supply. If you think about what's going on right now, if you have a cut, they'll give you quite a few days of these opioids. And when you don't need that many days.
Scott's administration has come under fire for favoring enforcement over treatment in this year's budget. While the governor signed off on a measure implementing mandatory minimum sentences for fentanyl possession, the state budget cut $11 million in mental health and substance abuse treatment.
Thanks to some of the reporting that has been done that we've seen in the last couple weeks, there's a little bit more awareness of where we ended up in the budget in the drug abuse and mental health area.
This is Clearwater Republican Senator Jack Latvala, speaking in August at a roundtable in Palm Beach County.
And I'm going to endeavor to shine a light on that and see if we can get our other partners in government to come to the table with us and see if we can provide a little more emphasis on that in the months ahead.
The loudest message coming out of that meeting was to increase funding for treatment. Alton Taylor leads the Drug Abuse Foundation of Palm Beach County.
They're sleeping in my parking lot. They're all over the place. They want treatment. I have 200 people 200 people today waiting on a waiting list.
Governor Scott already has the backing of leadership in the House and Senate for his new proposal. But details of how he plans to spend the $50 million haven't been released. Senator Latvala says he's pleased to see the governor focusing on the problem, and he's looking forward to working on the issue this session. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
Florida Secretary of State Ken Detzner announced this week his department's ready to launch the registertovoteflorida.gov website in compliance with the 2015 law that required online registration to be available by October 1st, and that's this Sunday. Detzner, who originally opposed the policy, said the Department of State's been working over the last 2 years in cooperation with the state's 67 supervisors of elections to implement some kind of online voter registration website. It would provide Floridians with a secure and more easily accessible way to register to vote. Residents can register to vote at the website or update their current registrations. They could also fill out and print a registration form that could be turned into a local supervisor of elections. Voters will need a Florida driver's license or state identification card and the last 4 digits of their Social Security numbers to register online, according to the Department of State. Advocates for a deaf inmate currently serving a life sentence for murder say they believe he's innocent and are optimistic he'll be released in the next several years. But as Sasha Cordner reports, the victim's family is hoping for a much different outcome.
I'm so committed to seeing this deaf man who is innocent to get free.
That's Pat Bliss, a retired paralegal who has been working for the past 22 years to free the person she now calls son from his life imprisonment. Felix Garcia, who's now in his mid to late 50s, is serving 99 years in prison for the 1981 murder of Joseph Trey Montana Jr. during an armed robbery. Since the time of the murder at the age of 19, Garcia has claimed he's innocent. The case has already divided the Garcia family, where some of Felix's own siblings have testified against him at his parole hearings. But Garcia's chief advocate, Pat Bliss, says two of his siblings have already submitted sworn statements stating they framed him for the murder.
We have Frank's confession in a 1989 affidavit that he outlaid the whole facts of the case, saying he was the killer and Felix was innocent. In 1996, he wrote another affidavit that what happened and that Felix was innocent. Felix had nothing to do with it. His sister wrote a similar affidavit, told how she was coerced to testify.
But the deceased victim's sisters told a different story during Garcia's most recent parole hearing. Jonah Dean, Trey Montana Gonzalez, was one of three sisters who traveled from Tampa Bay to Tallahassee for the hearing.
Both of the Garcia brothers continue to disrupt and devastate our lives with new versions of the planning and murder of my brother, each admitting to being the murderer while trying to clear the other. Each of them have had special trials where our family has listened to how one or the other has admitted to the murder, and their attorneys try to deceive the judges or parole commissioners, ignoring the facts surrounding the murder of my brother.
Every few years, the Trey Montana family comes to speak against Garcia's early release, and the sisters say it's taken a toll on their family. But Virginia Trey Montana Campa Moore says she knows they have to do it to help get justice for their murdered brother, Joseph, who they call JoJo.
Our family has been represented in the hearing for over 30 years. We are here today because this hearing is the most important, with the possibility of a calculated, cold-blooded murderer being set free. Our brother JoJo was one of 8 children. JoJo, being from a large family, is extremely close, dismissed every day, and we're very upset about the possibility of parole for the man who planned and carried out his murder, then bragged about it to his friends and family.
The family not only spoke against Garcia's early release, they also asked the members of the Florida Commission on Offender Review to provide a longer period of time between the hearings. The last hearing was in 2014. At that time, the parole board decided to lessen his sentence by a year. putting his earliest possible release date at 2025. Then they agreed to review his case again in 3 years. But during the recent hearing this year, commissioners said Garcia's guilt is not in dispute. They are keeping the presumptive 2025 release date and will review the case again in 2020. Still, attorney Reggie Garcia, who represents Felix and has no relation to him, says there's hope for his client since the outcome could have been worse.
They said, let's look at it again in 3 years. Let's refer Felix to special programming in Virginia. And then no change to the what's called PPRD, presumptive parole release date. So we would have loved the presumptive parole release to go down, but frankly, they can adjust that in either direction, hopefully down in 3 years.
As for Pat Blish, he says Felix Garcia is currently thriving in a Virginia prison where it's easier to communicate and there are more programs for deaf inmates. Earlier this year, Garcia had expressed frustration at not having a job yet or assigned to an improvement program, but Bliss says things are starting to look up.
His first year, he was not given any classes, so he did not do any programming. They didn't have any classes available due to the fact that it's a large, it was 3,500 inmates with only so many classes and so many jobs, so he did not have a class. He got a class this year in horticultural.
Parole commissioners say it will be easier for them to assess the deaf inmate in 3 years after they see how Garcia does with Virginia's different programs. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Kortner.
The Florida Supreme Court today rejected arguments by death row inmate Kerry Michael Lambrix that he should be spared from execution next week because a jury did not unanimously recommend that he receive the death penalty. Justices in a 5-1 decision helped clear the way for Lambrix to be put to death by lethal injection next Thursday at Florida State Prison. It was the second time this week that justices rejected an appeal by Lambrix, who was convicted of murdering Aylisha Bryant and Clarence Moore in 1983. Near LaBelle. Lambrix's attorneys contend he should be resentenced because a jury did not unanimously recommend he receive the death penalty. Jury unanimity has become a major issue since a January 2016 U.S. Supreme Court decision that found Florida's death penalty sentencing system unconstitutional because it gave too much authority to judges instead of juries. A subsequent Florida Supreme Court ruling said juries must unanimously agree on critical findings before judges can impose death sentences and must unanimously recommend the death penalty. But the Florida Supreme Court made the unanimity standard apply only to cases dating back to 2002, meaning it does not apply to Lambrix. You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, if there's a new baby on the way in your family, now might be the perfect time to start saving for their post-high school education. Of course, the first question any savvy consumer should ask about any major expense is, how much is this going to cost? Diana Curtin is a vice president at Hancock Bank in Tallahassee, and she knows the answers when it comes to the cost of a college education in Florida.
The in-state public tuition is, on average, $24,610. A moderate private university is $49,320. That includes tuition, fees, housing, meals, books, and supplies. It's not just the tuition and fees. There's more to the cost. And also, the average stay in a university now is not 4 years, it's actually 6 years.
Even though, as Marshall Kreiser, chancellor of the state university system of Florida, is quick to point out, there's been consistent downward pressure on that undergraduate time frame by the state's top elected officials.
Be mindful that our legislature a few years ago put a disincentive to going too far over the number of hours. There's actually an excess credit hour charge. You know, you think of the village. Well, the village has to be focused with the student on how many hours they've taken, what those hours are for, and aware that there is a path that I think is incredibly affordable.
A major part of that affordability, says Shannon Colavecchio, spokesperson for the Florida Prepaid Plan, is the Florida Prepaid Plan. Approved by the legislature in 1987, she notes it's the largest and most successful plan of its type in the country.
Over 300,000 students have gone to college actually in Florida using our prepaid plans. And the reason that it is so attractive, if you're going to do it monthly, for example, when you set your monthly payment for Johnny, who might be 2 years old, for the next 16 years, that monthly payment is going to stay the same.
But just as in planning for retirement, a savings plan for college shouldn't rely on a single source of funding. Banker Diana Curitan says she took a portfolio approach.
I ended up doing a 529 and the Florida prepaid for my children. And so I think that it's also a combination of investments are very good. And that's when you work with a financial advisor to find out what works best for you.
And Curitan explains what a 529 is.
A 529 is a college savings plan. There's a lot of advantages to it. You are able to deposit the money in and it grows tax-free. You also have flexibility in the beneficiaries. You are able to use it for culinary, tech school, graduate school, many different educational programs.
There is another very popular source of college money in Florida. It's called the Bright Futures Scholarship Program. Florida prepaid spokesperson Colavecchio says combining it with other funding sources can reduce financial stress on students and their families almost to the vanishing point.
The state will pay that Bright Futures plan first, and then what is left in their prepaid plan that they didn't have to use because they did get a scholarship, well, they don't ever lose that money because it is guaranteed by the state. So the great thing about that is whatever's left in their prepaid savings bank, so to speak, can either be refunded and used toward graduate school or put into a 529, or it can be basically transferred to another beneficiary in that family.
Today, just over half of Florida college and university students graduate in debt because of student loans. The good news is that's nearly 20 percentage points below the national average for graduate indebtedness, but it's still bad news for those who start their work lives under that burden. A portfolio of advanced savings and scholarships can essentially do away with the need for student loans. And Chancellor Kreiser says there's another benefit.
It is also more likely that a student who has a financial plan for how they're going to go to a college or university, they're more likely to complete and not run into financial challenges at the back end of their education. And too often we deal with students who are juniors or seniors who can't afford or believe they can't afford to continue. Tools like this, when they're part of what that family's planned for, make that a much stronger certainty.
But all of these experts agree you can't wait until the kids hit high school to start thinking about how they're going to pay for college. Our regular Capital Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capital Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. And join us again next week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capital Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capital Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.